WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for WGTD's morning show also comes to you from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. Before we get to today's morning show, a quick word about the morning shows that are coming up over the next couple of days. Tomorrow's program will include a brand new conversation with Martin Yates, one of the country's leading authorities on job search, and year after year writes one of the best-known, most read job search guides, and that job search guide is has its 30th anniversary edition this year. And we'll be talking with him on a portion of tomorrow's program. We're changing Thursday's lineup, and instead of what was originally announced, I'm going to be speaking with two choral directors from Carthage College, Dr. Eduardo Garcia Novelli, who conducts the Carthage Choir, and Dr. Peter Dene, who conducts the Women's Ensemble. Each of those groups are just back from spectacular European tours. I should say, I misspoke. The Carthage Choir is just back from Spain. The Women's Ensemble is just back from China. And we will have those two directors, along with several members from each ensemble, talking about their memorable trips. And on Friday, I speak with two professors from Carthage, Jeff Roberg and Penny Seymour, about the trip which they just made to Cuba. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived at WGTD.org. Click on Talk. This interview is from the archives, an interview with Tim Egan about his best-selling book, The Big Burn. A film about this, largely based on Tim Egan's wonderful book, is airing tonight on the PBS series American Experience. So in honor of this marvelous film, which I hope you'll be able to see tonight, here is my conversation from several years ago with Mr. Egan. I'm excited for the next few minutes as I speak with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter and author Timothy Egan. He has a series of superb books to his credit, including The Winemaker's Daughter, Breaking Blue, The Good Rain, The Worst Hard Time. His latest book is a superb look at an interesting chapter in American history early in the 20th century. The book is called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. Perhaps you heard Mr. Egan interviewed on Terry Gross's Fresh Air. If you heard that conversation, then you can understand how excited I am to speak with him. We are going to be hearing about a disastrous fire which engulfed a large swath of the American West in 1910, the largest ever forest fire in American history. And it points to the legacy of, among others, President Theodore Roosevelt and the whole notion of setting aside large swaths of American wilderness for the American public. So there is that struggle between those who wanted to see that accomplished and those who adamantly opposed that. Another kind of struggle to try to combat this gigantic forest fire in 1910. And the events which that set in motion to sort of re-strengthen and reshape the whole forest ranger industry. All of these stories and more told in this book, again, called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. It's published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And Timothy Egan, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be with you.
Ahead of us talking about this specific story, I wonder if you could just say a word about your great interest in American history and maybe some of the common threads that are woven through your various books.
Sure. And I didn't set out to have a life plan or a design to the books I write. I'm a Westerner, so I'm based in the West. I've written for the New York Times for 20 years, wandering around the West and much of the Midwest telling stories. And so I'm really interested in stories that seem to get lost, you know, things that happen at the margins. And the last book, I was lucky because I wrote about something that most Americans missed. I mean, we thought that the Dust Bowl, at least I thought, and many people thought, was about people who left, people who went to California, the great diaspora that's chronicled by John Steinbeck. But in fact, a larger story was that two-thirds of them didn't go anywhere. So I tried to just ask this question, what was it like to live through the worst, you know, environmental catastrophe of our time at a time when 25% of the people were out of work? And with the Big Burn, it's a similar thing. That I had heard of this fire as a kid. I'd heard of it as a man following forest fires and writing about them for the New York Times, and realized that it was one of these lost stories that had larger resonance. And then the third thing was, I really love these clashes where human beings go up against nature, not that we necessarily learn from them, but that there are rather, you know, familiar designs to how we approach them, both in a hubristic way and how we try to overcome them and whether we take away any lessons from them. And so in this largest wildfire in our history, which also was the first time we had tried to fight a wildfire as a nation, we assembled essentially an army to go up against this fire in the Northern Rockies in 1910, and there's so many things that are with us still. And that, anybody who looks at history looks at it from the storytelling standpoint and from the standpoint of, are there things that can still be applied to us today? And in that sense, this fire had all those, had those elements.
Hmm. Later in the interview, I will hope to ask you about what sorts of resources you were able to draw upon in order to tell this story with such amazing richness and detail. We'll get to that eventually. Let's turn, however, to the tremendously important figure of Theodore Roosevelt, and actually to a very strong connection which he had with another major player in all of this. This is something you discuss in the first chapter of the book, which you title A Peculiar Intimacy, to describe President Theodore Roosevelt, soon to be President Theodore Roosevelt, because I guess we're talking about 1899 at this moment, when he is yet just vice president. Tell us about this interesting person and the prospect of peril, which you say first united them.
Well, I would argue that probably, with the exception of Abraham Lincoln, there is no more fascinating multiple character, more nuanced president than Theodore Roosevelt. And when you look up at his visage chiseled in Mount Rushmore, you realize there are 10 men in the face of the one man there. Because, I mean, just as a quick background, he's a son of wealth and privilege. He grows up in New York City. He's the only native of New York City ever to become president. He has a meteoric career. He's told as a young man he probably should never go outdoors, that he's sickly. He probably will die by his 21st birthday if he doesn't cultivate the indoor life. He defies the doctors. He builds his body, builds his mind, graduates from Harvard, has this amazing rise early on in his 20s. But then on Valentine's Day, 1884, he loses both his wife and his mother on the same day. His wife dies giving childbirth. His mother dies from an ailment. Unrelated, of course, in the same house in New York City. So he moves out west, and he basically spends 2 years alone as a hermit, as a cowboy in the Dakota Territory. And the West changes him. The West restores him. The West makes him look at this country in a different way. And the conservationist that he became, the person who set aside enough land equal to the size of France, is essentially born in the grief-stricken young man who goes west. So you have that side. That's his sort of genesis of Roosevelt and how he found his heart again after losing it on Valentine's Day. It was through the West. It was through the outdoors. And then he meets this guy, Gifford Pinchot, also a son of privilege, a guy who grows up in one of his homes is a castle overlooking the Delaware River with 27 fireplaces and 63 turrets. He goes out west as a young man, finds himself, sleeps on cold ground, becomes an ascetic, mystic, wanders in the woods, John Muir becomes his mentor. And these two individuals who meet as in the chapter called A Peculiar Intimacy, they meet in the governor's mansion, and what they do is they talk about how the industrial age seems to be destroying the American Eden. And then because they were both very athletic, they stripped under their underpants and wrestle and fight. Have this boxing match and this, you know, that sort of bonds them. Roosevelt becomes president accidentally. McKinley dies. He's assassinated. Roosevelt's our youngest president. He wants to change the United States. He says later, I wanted to make the Republican Party into a fairly radical progressive party. And to do that, he needs his old friend Gifford Pinchot. And then they set out in the course of the next 7 years to build the conservation dream, which is national parks, national forests, national wildlife refuges, all the land that we Americans own in common. And they do it with a Republican Party, a hostile Republican Party in some stages. Now, all of that is in peril on the eve of the fire. We can get to that in a moment. But that's essentially what these two people accomplish as young men.
I want you to speak for just a moment about Mr. Pinchot's connection with John Muir, who has a very strong connection to the state of Wisconsin. And so I think it's worth mentioning him in a little more detail than we otherwise might. And I want you to talk about some of these extraordinary trips which Muir and Pinchot took together and the way in which they bonded on some of these trips and the way in which it really especially reshaped Mr. Pinchot and what was most important to him.
There's no way to understate how famous John Muir was in his time. Not only was he a familiar figure with this long beard and this sprightly gait of his, but he was a terrific writer. He had wit and insight and humor, and he could really turn a phrase. He was an absolute celebrity on a scale that few writers today are. Also, as a native son of both Scotland and Wisconsin, you know who he is. He was a child, grew up on a farm in a big family, and talked about how he became close to beasts of burden because he, you know, had pulled a plow behind a mule, and it made him close to animals and what it was like. He wanders around, Muir does, and not until his 30s does he really sort of find himself. And then in his 40s, he marries a woman of wealth, and he himself has time on his hands. Yosemite changes him, Yosemite, California, and he starts to think of these ideas of preserving somewhat of the United States. He's I guess, one of the three founders of the American conservation movement. But Pinchot and he had a lot in common. They were both mystics in that Pinchot had a strange spiritual life. He would wander off by himself quite a bit. People were always struck by the strangeness of Pinchot, that he was rich and he was well educated and he was Ivy Leaguer and he was attractive, but he was a loner. And Muir mentored him in that regard. Muir used to write him letters and say, "You're going the right way. It is okay to sleep alone in the woods. You're doing good work." And you know, Muir himself was somewhat odd. He would lash himself to a tree during a windstorm as a way to experience what the wild was like. And so when he meets Pinchot, who often slept on a wooden pillow and had his valet wake him up with a splash of water in the morning, they're like-minded souls. Now, before Roosevelt calls Pinchot to help him with the conservation dream as president, Pinchot is the founding forester. He was literally the first professional forester in the United States. And he's given a series of assignments by other presidents to scout the American wilderness and see what can be done with the big leftover territory of the Louisiana Purchase. And on several of these trips, he takes along John Muir with him. And so they spend countless nights in places today that most Americans know as vacation spots. They go to Crater Lake in Oregon, and Muir writes in his diary, everyone slept in the tent except for Pinchot. They go to the Grand Canyon, and Muir writes that Pinchot wanted to kill a tarantula, but Muir would not let him because he said they were living things together, and they had this in common. So they essentially roam all over the West and bond spiritually and sort of, because remember, this is a time when the American industrial might is at its peak. The railroads, the mining companies, the timber companies were just tearing at the American Eden, were strapping railroad tracks across the country, were this American colossus, as Pinchot said, is at work. And these two have much in common. And later they will influence so much of what we have today. But they're known mainly for the break that came later in their life over whether to dam Hetch Hetchy in Yosemite National Park. And I think that's unfair to both Muir and Pinchot. For almost 20 years, these two people were as tight as two people could be. And they did change the United States. But remember this, Muir didn't have to govern. He could give these big speeches before thousands of people and write these magnificent tracts, which he did. Pinchot had to govern. He and Roosevelt had a hostile Republican Congress. So I think Pinchot does get shortchanged. But they were very close for almost 20 years and only broke at near the very end of Muir's life.
Hmm. We need to talk about kind of a shift in policy and attitude and some of what occurs just past the turn of the century. But in order to understand that, I think we need to step back just a little bit. I think a lot of us, if we do not know our history thoroughly, have this understanding that Theodore Roosevelt created all of our state parks and national parks and national forests and so on. And in fact, there were some of these areas that had already been set aside well before Theodore Roosevelt comes on the scene. Just sketch for us a bit of that history, and then what changes with mm-hmm. President Roosevelt.
I'm glad you said that, because it isn't like this thing came out of thin air. There were, of course, state parks, and there were a few set-aside areas, but it was really revolutionary what Roosevelt and with the help of Pinchot did, though. We had a handful of national parks when Roosevelt took office. Yellowstone was the first national park created in 1876 by Ulysses Grant, I believe. Yosemite followed shortly thereafter. So we had a couple of parks, and if you saw the Ken Burns public television series, you see how those came about. And there were people who were talking about the national park concept. And these were mainly the crown jewels, the scenic wonders that we all know. What was so different about what Pinchot and Roosevelt did was the Forest Service is all the sort of leftover land. In short time, they set aside about 200 million acres. Now, you can't understate how big an area that is. The whole Roosevelt public land legacy is an area almost as big as the size of France. So the national parks were a very small part of it, just a mere fraction. And they were, again, the scenic jewels, which the railroad companies wanted because they could bring people out by train to look at these places. They didn't want the national forests. And these were supposed to be not roped-off wilderness, but the people's land. So the idea was this was land that would be used by all the people and used for future generations and used in different ways. There would be some logging, there would be some recreation, there would be some set-asides. They weren't necessarily roped-off wilderness. But it was a radical thought. Now, I have seen in the book where the Congress is really upset at what they're doing. Roosevelt is creating these national forests right and left, and he's doing it by executive order. And the Congress finally passes a bill to stop him from doing this. He has 2 days to sign it. Well, what Roosevelt does is he has his rangers go out and come up, bring him back all these maps, and they sit on the floor of the White House for the next 12 hours, and they draw these boundaries, what we now know is some of our greatest national forests. And they're doing it on the floor of the White House, and Roosevelt is having a great time, and he's almost laughing. He's going, oh, we got to put in this valley. I remember being up there once. This is magnificent. Oh, God, for sure we have to include this mountain range here. It's magnificent. And he's literally drawing in all these boundaries. Now, again, it's important for your listeners to know this is not private land that's being taken away. This is the public domain left over from basically the Louisiana Purchase. But they used to just give it to railroads and big syndicates. And then what's revolutionary about what Roosevelt does is they give it they say, these are their words, to the little guy. Now, when the fire happens, again, this land is in peril.
One of the, I think, most interesting lines that helps us understand why there were some sectors that violently opposed what President Roosevelt was doing is actually a line which is a bit earlier in the book. This is from 1890, actually, so we're not even to William McKinley yet.
Mm-hmm.
But this is at a moment you describe in which Pinchot expresses dismay at how Americans viewed their public domain. You write, "What was hailed in Europe as a glorious swath of unspoiled creation was viewed in his native land as a plunderer's buffet."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is, it's almost kind of frightening to think about the gigantic philosophical divide that there at least appears to be between those perspectives on what this vast openness means.
Right, and we take that point of view that Roosevelt and Pinchot brought to us somewhat for granted now because our country is split along. I mean, you look at these polls and the majority believes that it's good to set aside land for future generations, but 100 years ago or 120 years ago, the time when you're using this quote, this was a radical thought. As a nation, we were barely 100 years old, and what Roosevelt saw is that broken-hearted young man in the Dakota Territory was that everything that we now straddled, this great continent and the wild nature of it, was diminishing. That the bison were gone, the wolves were gone, that Indians were pushed off to the edge, the birds were gone, the forests were being leveled, the plains were being overturned, which would soon lead to the Dust Bowl a mere generation and a half later. And they were appalled by this. And most people didn't see it that way. They only saw it as progress. They saw it as a one-way street. So having been in Europe and seeing that they had no wild changed both Roosevelt and Pinchot because they came back and they said, my God, what does the United States have? We don't have castles. We don't have great art museums. We don't have lords of the manor. We have the wild.
Hmm.
So that was a revolutionary thought then to try to put the brakes on what was considered nonstop progress. And I'm glad you mentioned that because, again, we take all thought for granted as it eventually evolves, you know, whether it's race or the outdoors or something. But it took a lot of sort of major change in thinking for us to get to that point.
Right. And of course, President Roosevelt is completely at odds with certain men that at one point you described them as titans, as another mm-hmm. point, Western landlords,
mm-hmm.
Accustomed to getting land for free. Who were some of these Western titans and landlords? And what was it that ultimately was, in effect, taken away from them?
Well, this is another thing where history echoes somewhat of the present day. Not until 5 years ago, when we had the big Wall Street peak just before the Wall Street crash, had there been a greater gap in American history between rich and poor. We had never had more concentrated wealth. There were a handful of families. We know them now mainly as philanthropies. This is the Guggenheims, J.P. Morgan, Morgan, by the way, hated Roosevelt. And when Roosevelt left office in 1909 on the eve of the fire that forms the Big Burn, Morgan famously said, because Roosevelt went off to Africa, Morgan said, "I trust some lion will do his duty." And he was speaking about what he hoped would be Roosevelt's fate. The Rockefeller family, which is building a railroad across the very area where this fire will be, John D. Rockefeller had 4 times the wealth of Bill Gates today, adjusted for inflation. I did the numbers on that.
Wow.
So these people had owned the railroads, they owned the copper, which was used for telephones, they owned most of the natural resources, the timber, and there was a big populist movement, a lot of it generated out of Minnesota and Wisconsin and the upper Midwest, against concentration of wealth. Now, Roosevelt, a Republican, took his party against these people, and they really pushed back. Now, the last big clash of these Gilded Age titans, these Rockefellers, Morgans, Guggenheims, J.J. Hill, who built the railroads, was where this fire took place, in the upper northern Rockies, because they wanted this land for timber, for railroads, for other things. So it was really the end of this fascinating Gilded Age that lasted, gosh, most of 40 years when you had an incredible concentration of wealth. And Roosevelt went after him in other ways, too, but that's another subject, the antitrust violations.
We're speaking with Timothy Egan, and we're talking about his book called The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America. I don't remember if we've really clarified this, but the most dramatic events that we're talking about involving President Roosevelt occur after his election in 1905. He, of course, succeeds William McKinley on McKinley's assassination in 1901, and although he certainly makes some things happen, Roosevelt becomes far more aggressive with his win, I mean his election to a second term, which I think you tell us is among the most decisive presidential victories up until that time. And that's part of what gives Roosevelt, in a sense, the political clout and will to enact some of these sweeping changes.
That's exactly right. Remember, when he's president, and he is the youngest president, Kennedy was the youngest elected, but Roosevelt was the youngest ever to serve as president. He's the accidental president. They had put him on the ticket because they wanted to get rid of him. He was the reformist Republican governor of New York, and they didn't like his reformist policies. They thought he would be in the Siberia of the vice presidency. Well, McKinley's assassinated. Roosevelt assumes office, and he still feels that this is the McKinley mandate. So it isn't until he wins in this epic landslide that he feels that the people are with him, that they know what he's up to. He has started to talk about conservation. This is a word they introduced to the American public. They say they invented this term, Roosevelt and Pinchot. So they're starting to talk about this. They're talking about breaking up the trust. They're starting to talk about their legacy. It's interesting to see now, we're a nation of more than 300 million people, but then we were a nation of 92 million people. And they talk time and again, one day we will be a nation of 300 million people. And what do we owe those future generations? It's amazing to see someone project out that far. So winning in 1905, or starting the second term in 1905 with a landslide, Roosevelt feels that he's not fooling the public. They know what they've got here. He's not being deceptive. And by the way, for your listeners who don't know this, the term bully pulpit, well, the president uses bully pulpit. Roosevelt invented that term because that was his favorite expression. He would say, oh, bully for this or bully for that, and pound the podium. He loved to get in his opponent's face. He said, I go hard at everyone. And there was nothing that invigorated him more than political battle itself. Well, there was something. It would probably be, you know, hiking 10 miles in the morning, but he loved political battle.
So with the renaming of the United States Forest Service and the transfer of funds to it, Pinchot is named its first chief. You quote him as saying, it was a job worth more to me than all the treasures of all the pirates of history.
Yeah, and, great phrase, isn't it?
I love that. It's absolutely wonderful. And of course, he is in effect entrusted with this vast expanse of forest and its safety. And with that comes what seems to be what you seem to describe as a bit of a shift in his thinking regarding fire. Tell us, first of all, what Pinchot seems to have once believed about fire and forests, and how, at least in terms of his public stance, how that attitude changed.
Well, I'm glad you asked that, too, because it's a fascinating arc of Pinchot's life, how he goes from a very humble young man who wants nothing more in life than to be the first forester. So you read that marvelous quote from his diary where he talked how happy he was to finally be the forester in charge. He's the founding forester. He's in charge of this great swath of wilderness, and he has all these young men come out of Yale. The first forestry school is endowed with Pinchot family money, and those are his rangers, and they're full of inspiration. They call it the Great Crusade. But Pinchot himself, you know, working in Washington, D.C., knows that to get all of this, which is what he'd wanted, and the Congress would not give it to him. They wouldn't create the Forest Service. They created the National Forest, but no Forest Service. So essentially, the land was used and abused as always until the Forest Service came. In order to do that, he knows he has to make somewhat of a pact. And that's my thesis, I guess, is that Pinchot knew that fire was part of nature. He knew because he was a scientist himself, and he knew But he tells the public that if you give me this Forest Service, if you create the Forest Service, we can stop fire. He says, almost by way of inviting this fire, 2 months before the big burn in 1910, he writes an op-ed where he says, "We know now that fire is something that man," I'm paraphrasing now, "man himself can control, that it's no longer something to be feared." Remember, I'd said all these elements are taken out of the wild, except for one, which is fire. And Pinchot holds out that fire is something that we can overcome. Well, the big burn comes along on August 20th, 1910, and it's catastrophic. There's nothing like this in our history. It's 3 million acres, 5 towns burned to the ground, 100 people die. Again, we've never seen anything like it either. It's the size of Connecticut burning in a weekend. And it humbles him somewhat. But we don't see it until late in life. So I have a scene in the book where an older Gifford Pinchot, almost 80 years old, returns to the scene of the fire. And now he realizes that the younger Gifford Pinchot, who had sold the Forest Service to the public with the promise that we could control fire, was full of it, at least full of hubris.
Right.
And he's a changed man.
You tell us that one of the ways in which he could drive home his point and secure what he wanted to secure was to really, in your words, he needed to count on people being terrified. Mm-hmm. And one of the means by which to do that was to remind people about two of the worst fires that America had experienced up until that time, one of which, the worst of all, occurred here in Wisconsin, the Peshtigo Fire, which coincidentally occurred exactly the same time as the Chicago Fire, mm-hmm. and then a remarkably horrific fire in Hinckley, Minnesota. I've talked about that on the morning show because of someone who wrote mm-hmm. a book about that terrible, terrible fire. So there were stories that one could tell, and you didn't have to turn all that far back in history to bring stories before the public that really would terrify them.
That's exactly right, and I'm glad you brought up those two fires. People sort of argue on one point about what was a bigger fire. Those were more catastrophic in terms of loss of human life. This fire, the Big Burn, was bigger just in terms of its pure size and ferocity. But this was a time when cities were burning to the ground. I mean, we forget that now because our cities are built of stone and concrete and steel rebar, and we don't remember when Chicago and Denver and San Francisco and Seattle and all these towns were wiped off the map in a hot sweep of 5 days. And so people were terrified, utterly terrified of the prospect of fire coming in and wiping an area out. So, again, I'm glad you mentioned that because it does put it into perspective how this was the last thing that people truly feared. Hmm. And by holding out that his forest rangers could beat that, he's essentially saying, there's an enemy at the door and my soldiers will keep you safe.
Hmm. You write at one point, in the way that people anthropomorphized it, fire was the final menace of the frontier,
mm-hmm.
as if the land itself were slowing off all attempts at establishing order in the woods.
Absolutely, because it really was. I mean, I can't say it any better than I just said it there. that's truly how I felt.
And of course, in the wake of that, then, what is Pinchot given?
Well, he's given, for the first time, a corps of professional foresters, which he wanted his whole life. Again, I said, national forests are created, but there's no one in charge of them. It doesn't mean anything to have national forests if there's no cop on the beat. He finally is given a corps of professional foresters, these people who come out of Yale, young men in their 20s, sent out west. Each ranger had an average of 300,000 acres per person. That was their beat. And they're sent out west to patrol this land, to convince people that they can make peace with it, that they can be the neighbors with national forests, all of this. And so he is given his dream, but he's given it thinking they can control fire. They know nothing about fire. So when the big burn happens in 1910 and they assemble 10,000 men to fight these smaller fires that have not yet merged into the big burn, they don't have any idea what they're doing. Though Pinchot had told the public that fire is now the last thing that man can control, they can't control it. They have no idea how to control it. And when this blow up happens, it's catastrophic, and they lose. They're routed. I mean, men are killed in ponds with trees crashing down on them. They run into caves, and the firestorm itself finds them because it's seeking oxygen. They die, you know, when the firewall overcomes them. These horrific deaths. They're routed. But, and this is the point of the book, that's why I call it The Fire That Saved America, it makes heroes and martyrs out of them. The public sees these young men in the same way that 500 years ago the Brits saw knights as mythic and heroic. They die for the, quote, Great Crusade of Roosevelt. So it changes public sentiment for the Forest Service. And then they create national forests in the East as a direct result of this fire. And then they double the funding of the Forest Service as a direct result of this fire.
Hmm.
Go ahead.
I think it's important, in order for us to fully appreciate this veneration, to understand that before these events occur, that the typical forest ranger was often not held in even plain old respect. In fact, you tell us that the forest rangers were despised in much of the West, scorned as Teddy Roosevelt's Boy Scouts, or worse, hapless elites from the Yale School of Forestry. Can you describe a little further this interesting dynamic which was at play, and I assume was at play maybe right from the start?
Absolutely, and you even see parts of it right now. It's a culture clash is what it is. The West is still fairly wide open, and you've got these towns that are like Deadwood. There's houses of prostitution, there are mining and timber thieves, there are public land thieves, there are card sharks, there are murderers, there are all manner of people coursing through these public woods. And so these kids get out of Yale, and they're just imbued with inspiration, and they want to go west and fulfill Gifford Pinchot's dream, and they're horrified by what they find. In Montana, a forest ranger is shot and killed, and no charges are ever brought against the shooter because he said he thought the guy was a deer. In Idaho, on the Montana border, two young rangers see these women setting up a house of prostitution. They're horrified. They telegram Missoula, and they say, two undesirable prostitutes setting up brothel on public land. What should we do? And some smart aleck wires back, get two desirable ones. I mean, this is really it's wide open. It's they're harassed in the woods. So, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. It's not only these Gilded Age powers and a hostile Congress, which is after them, but the people themselves don't seem to want them. Now, by contrast, today, 20 million people live within a half mile of a national forest. They love the Forest Service. It's next to the Park Service. Poll after poll shows the most beloved government agency that we have. So it's really changed in the 100 years.
Hmm. We should say that much of your book is devoted to the incredible change that occurs when Theodore Roosevelt leaves office in 1909, and his successor, his really hand-selected successor, William Howard Taft, takes over as president. He is incredibly ineffective. I think many people do know the story of that. Mm-hmm. And I remember at one point you used the term tone deaf, politically tone deaf, to describe President Taft about one matter or another. Describe what occurs to the Forest Service in the wake of Roosevelt leaving office in terms of sort of the opposition which begins to mount.
You know, two things happen. First of all, Taft, though he had made a promise to Roosevelt and Pinchot that he would continue their policies, does not continue their policies because my theory at least is that he's afraid of confrontation. Whereas Roosevelt loved to get in the face of his opponents, Taft hates it. He wants nothing more than, you know, to have his afternoon nap, to have everyone like him. He's 350 pounds, and the press makes fun of his weight and his girth, and they shoot these pictures of him from behind, and they call it Aft Taft, and they make fun of him at one point because he brings a new bathtub into the White House. And so he's very sensitive to these slights about his weight. He doesn't like conflict. And Gifford Pinchot stays on after Roosevelt leaves. Pinchot thinks, you know, my foresters need me. There's this connection with these young rangers. But Taft fires him. So at the start of 1910, the year of the fire, the agency is essentially orphaned. It's without its leader. And I found some of these letters in the National Archives that the rangers wrote saying, you were our lodestar. You were our the man we followed. With you gone, we have no light. I mean, it was amazing how what a connection they felt to Pinchot. When he's gone, they have no leader. At the same time, the Congress is picking them apart. They're these senators, which had always opposed the Forest Service, are now having their way. And Taft is not defending them. So their budget is being cut. Their salaries are cut in half. They're without their leader. They're essentially left to die. And Taft says something interesting later I found in one of the books on him. It really was a fascinating comment. He serves only one term, of course. He's routed from office in 1912. No incumbent president suffers a bigger loss. He takes only two states. He goes on to become a Supreme Court justice, but he says later, I don't remember that I ever was president. I just found astonishing.
Right. And in terms of what he was able to accomplish, or to what extent he was able to enact his own political
right.
will, those words make some sense, some yes. terrible sense. So it is... then that the stage is set, in a sense, for this horrific fire which breaks out on the 20th of August in 1910. And your book is an amazingly detailed account of this incredible fire, unprecedented in its scope. I wonder if you could just describe to what resources you could turn in order to tell this story in such incredible detail.
Well, again, it's in the Forest Service's, among the Forest Service Rangers, this is their creation story. And so they have kept very careful annotations of how this thing happened. And I did two things. First, I went around to all the ranger districts in the West that were somewhat affected by this fire, and it's three states, Montana, Idaho, and Washington. And you go into, say, the Clearwater National Forest in Idaho or the Flathead National Forest in Montana, and you go to the Ranger District and you ask about the Big Burn, and they immediately smile because in a back room are some huge archives on this stuff. And they did these. The people who were the original Forest Rangers were called the Arrangers because they actually drew the boundaries. And so there's all these wonderful memories of the early Forest Service, which they've stapled together and keep in these back rooms and these incredible details of what it was like and what the fire was like. The second thing was in the National Archives. Later, I found fabulous detail of what this thing was like because it was a big deal in its time. It was the Hurricane Katrina of fires. And the third thing was I was lucky enough to find some. There's one woman who outlives everybody in this fire. She was a homesteader who was caught up in the middle of it and sort of drafted, conscripted to be a cook. And she dies in the 1970s in her 90s.
But oh, yes. Ione Pinky Adair.
Pinky Adair, exactly. They call her that because she had a shock of red hair. And she sits down for 2 days before she dies with a oral historian and gives her account of this thing. So there are really wonderfully textured accounts of what it was like to live through this thing among the heroes and the average people. And that's really what I'm interested in. So much of history gets told through the great men, and certainly I tell history through Roosevelt and Pinchot, but I also love the story that happens at the margins, the average people. So I traced these Italian immigrants all the way back to their home in Italy. They died in the fire. I traced these African-American soldiers, Buffalo soldiers, who fight this thing despite the racism when they arrive. And they have pretty good institutional accounts in their ranks, too. And I trace just average folks who were thrown into this thing. And so there's pretty good archival and lettered stuff if you're willing to spend the time looking for it.
Mm-hmm. And we're glad that you spent the time to give this story such incredible texture. Those Italians are especially poignant, Domenico Bruno and Giacomo Vietone. You write that they traveled more than 6,000 miles to find work to help their peasant families in the Italian Piemonte. And they unfortunately were one of many who were consumed trying to fight this blaze. One of the things you tell us is that those who set about trying to combat this gigantic fire for the most part, had no idea what they were doing. Although I suppose in some respects, this is also one of those fires where even more know-how and more resources might not have been enough to make much of a difference.
Yes, that's correct. That's my assessment. And I think other people who've looked at this fire from the lens that we have today, where we fight fires with, you know, retardant dropped by airplanes and big bulldozers and the full industrial force, would tell you that if a fire like this happened today, we would still be largely helpless. And that's because the storm itself, which is what drew me to this book initially before I even looked at Roosevelt or the backstory, was just extraordinary. It was a phenomenon of just laws of physics and fire. I mean, 70-mile-an-hour winds caused this thing to get up on its feet and start to roar through the Bitterroot Mountains. 70-mile-an-hour winds are hurricane-force winds, which can knock a human being down no matter how tightly you're gripping onto something. And when this fire was at its full peak, it was moving, as everyone said at the time, faster than a horse could go at full gallop. There's really nothing you could do when a firestorm like that happens. We've seen these things since, and people die, and they wonder why we even put human beings in their wake. So it was nothing that, let's say they had 100,000 men they could have stopped. But again, it had larger resonance, not just in saving the Forest Service, but thereafter they vowed to try to put out every fire. And that had sort of, you know, interesting consequences with us today.
Hmm. You call this at one point a single all-consuming storm. One of the people who was not killed, but in some ways utterly consumed by the fire, was a man by the name of Ed Pulaski. Can you just say a quick word about his story, which we can read in greater detail in your
book?
Right.
Some people know the Pulaski name because there's a bank in the Midwest, and there's, you know, the Count Casimir Pulaski. There's Pulaski Days. He was the revolutionary hero. Well, this fellow was a different Pulaski, a distant descendant. And he was blue-collar. He wasn't a Yale-trained forester, but he was a middle-aged man, found himself a forest ranger. And no one was more heroic in the Big Burn than Ed Pulaski, who saves the lives of 50 people. But he ultimately, and I don't want to spoil the story, has somewhat of a bitter and tragic end himself. But to this day, any forest ranger will tell you, when you say Pulaski, they'll talk about their tool, which is called a Pulaski. It's a combination axe and hoe, which anyone who's ever fought a fire uses. He invented the Pulaski, never was lucky enough to get the patent for that, but his name is as well known as Gifford Pinchos among anyone who's ever worked for the United States Forest Service.
Hmm. So what is the ultimate legacy of the Big Burn? What ultimately changes because of it?
One thing that happens is that they vow to put out every fire. So they start something called the 10 o'clock rule, which is that if you see a fire the day it happens, it has to be put out by 10 o'clock the next day. And it's impossible to put out every fire, but they try to do that. And it has tragic consequences. Two reasons. A lot of people, not a lot, but enough people die later trying to put out every fire. And Norman McLean, the great Montana writer, wrote about that in his book, Young Men and Fire, which was a 1949 disaster. The other thing is that because they try to put out every fire and take fire from nature, we have all this fuel buildup, as they call it. We have trees that should have burned years ago. And so some of the bigger fires that we see in the latter half of the 20th century are a direct result of their trying to put out every fire. It's because all this fuel is built up. And scientists will tell you that some of the bigger fires that are projected in the next 10, 20 years are, again, a result of trying to put everything out. So its legacy is thus: it saves the Forest Service, it saves the public land dream, and that's, I think most Americans would say, a good thing. But they learned the wrong fire lesson, which is that thinking that they could overcome it. Now, we did change. About 10 years ago, the Forest Service finally, fascinating comment from the director of the Forest Service, he said, fire is neither good nor bad, it just is. And he says it has a place in the wild. So they sort of come to peace with it almost 100 years after the Big Burn.
And again, an amazing, harrowing account of this actual fire itself fills much of this fascinating book. And again, so much of the rich historical context in which these events emerged and their aftermath as well, all told masterfully in this book, The Big Burn, Teddy Roosevelt and the Fire That Saved America, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, the author, Timothy Egan. Timothy Egan, what a great pleasure and honor for me to speak with you today about your amazing book. Thank you.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the interview.
And a reminder that tonight on the PBS series American Experience,